Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or just trying to make life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Today I talked to Murali Amula, the outgoing editor-in-chief of the University of Guelph's student newspaper, The Ontarian. In its last issue of the semester, The Ontarian announced that it was going to a monthly printing schedule and making other changes to their format and revenue structure. The Ontarian, it seems, is not immune to the titanic shifts in the business, even as a student-run press. So what does the student press look like now, and how will The Ontarian be chasing that as it heads into the future? We'll put that to the person who just oversaw the most recent year of the paper. The evolving face of the student press is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. You've probably heard this before, but I was once the editor-in-chief of The Ontarian. It's a daunting legacy. The paper started in 1951, before there was even a University of Guelph, just three colleges cloistered here at the top of the hill on Gordon Street. There were controversies over communism and race in the 1960s. There was the great schism in the 80s when some Ontarian members thought the paper was getting too corporate and then splintered off into the Peak. And then 1970, in its most notorious episode, The Ontarian printed the FLQ manifesto, which prompted the RCMP to seize all copies directly from the printer. That is a lot of history, and there are thousands of people that were a part of it. My year, which was the 2007-2008 school year, was one of great profitability for the paper, which was, of course, reinvested into the pages of the next year's editions. I have a feeling, though, that mine might have been the last year of considerable profitability at The Ontarian. That fall, the Great Recession accelerated the systemic issues that print media was already facing. National ad revenue dried up for a time, and when it came back, it was all going digital and going to places like Facebook and Google instead of the local papers. Bolstered by student fees, though, and with a niche audience and coverage area, student papers have been able to weather the storm a bit better than their local and national counterparts. But even that most dependable revenue stream is now under threat. The Ford government's Student Choice Initiative means that students can opt out of paying fees to select campus groups, including their student papers. The Ontarian's own unscientific poll says that only 57% of undergrads will continue to voluntarily give the paper their $3.12 every semester. So the business is changing, and it's a change that the current and incoming wave of Ontarian staff members and volunteers are trying to deal with. That's partially what we're talking about today with Murali Amula. On this week's edition of the podcast, she'll talk about her year and her tenure at The Ontarian and how she thinks her and her staff have reacted to the changes affecting the paper. We also talk about where The Ontarian sits in the news diet of students and how recent events may have changed that, and we'll talk about what The Ontarian might look like 5 years from now and what she will be doing next and what skills she's learned that she will be taking with her as she looks for her next job. So I caught up with Murali Amula earlier this week at the opposite end of the second floor of the UC from the Ontarian office. Murali Amula, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So how do you feel being at the end of the year? How does facing the other end of your time at The Ontarian suit you now?
Yeah, well, I think it's always kind of bittersweet because you've made friends and you've figured out how to do things and how things work. And just when you feel like you've gotten the hang of something, it's time to move on to other things. But I think that's true of any contract work or passion project that people have. So, yeah, it's nice to be moving on to whatever the unknown is in the future. But well, definitely had a really good experience at The Ontarian over the last 3 years.
Can I ask why you wanted to be editor-in-chief of The Ontarian? Everybody comes to it for different reasons.
Yeah, so I didn't start with The Ontarian with the intention of being editor-in-chief by any means. I started off just volunteering there while I was job searching after I finished graduate school here. And it was just a way of, like, writing about theater and comedy in ways that other people would read. And then there was a position opened up to be digital content editor. And so I was digital content editor for a year. And then after that, I applied to editor-in-chief, and they were kind enough to keep me for 2 years instead of the normal 1 year. So, yeah, it was a good experience.
So you got a double dose, which was which is not usual.
No.
So, yeah, and plus you were a digital content editor, mm-hmm. which didn't exist when I was at the Ontarian.
Yes.
And I think it points to, you know, what some of the changes have been at the paper over the last... Well, when was I there? 12 years ago, almost. Yeah. So it strikes me as, you know, you're sort of in a unique position where you were helping to transition. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's been a lot of hay about the Ontarian going to a monthly print schedule. So can you talk a bit about what's going on in your newsroom, that, you know, the pressures you're facing, how the business model's changing? That may be a lot to ask, but answer in one question. But, you know, just in terms of what you've seen in your 10 years, how has what you do at the Ontarian changed?
Sure, yeah. I can definitely answer it from my perspective. I think when I started 3 years ago, like you said, there was this new digital content editor position. So it was very well known among the staff at the time. As you know, we switch every year, basically. Mm-hmm. So everyone knew that we needed to do more on digital, and that's what students are into and ways that they like to get their news and information. And so it was known that we had to do that. And so that first year, with the digital content editor position, it was very much like a sort of experiment to see what how much there was to do in that area. Mm-hmm. And so I was doing all of the WordPress web stuff, and then I was also doing the social media stuff, which hadn't been done really with a great deal of regularity over the years. Mm-hmm. And from that, we found very quickly, because it was like a part-time position, and I was working more than full-time hours doing the two sides of it, we learned quickly that it needed to be two separate positions. So when I was editor-in-chief the first year, we kind of changed the position a little bit to kind of make all of the section editors also be doing the stuff on WordPress and that aspect of it, and focus more on the social media type of aspect kind of separately. So we had a kind of a marketing assistant and a digital content editor. And then this year we did something similar. We changed the marketing assistant to like a social media and outreach person. So they focused on our all of our Facebook, Instagram, Twitter posts and tabling events and stuff like that. And the digital content editor position's really evolving into someone who has a great deal of ability with coding and stuff like that. So it's much more technical of a role than when I started. And it's been a smooth transition. And I think a lot of people have started paying attention to this transition and like viewing it as something drastic that's come out of the Student Choice Initiative. But that hasn't been the case. It's been an ongoing transition for definitely the 3 years that I've been there, from what I've observed. And we've developed a plan to roll out over the next 5 years, kind of starting in 2020, publishing year. And it's been going well. Like, I think all of the things that we're doing are based on what we've heard from students. So there might be people who are not happy with it, and there might be people who are super happy about it. But it's all stuff that we've thought through quite for a long extent of time and gotten a lot of feedback from people. We've conducted readership research, and you can't ever make everyone happy, but we're trying to make sure that we are serving the needs of the readership.
So there are students who were mad about going to the monthly?
I don't think so,
because that seems
really
like the old timers like me.
Yeah. I don't think there are students who are mad about it. I think there's some students who are just like, why are you doing a print version at all? And then I know there's some students who like having a physical copy. So I think they would have been upset if we didn't do print at all anymore.
Yeah.
And there is something about being in the newspaper. I think if you're just passing by and reading it, you don't really care that much. But as soon as you're mentioned in it or your friends mentioned in it, you come by the office and you go, hey, can I have 20 copies of this to give to all of my friends? So there is something special about that and the archival function of it that you don't get with online stuff. Right. So I think what we're switching to is kind of, it's all in flux, but it's what we think is the best approach right now. And of course, we're always taking feedback and tweaking things and seeing what changes get thrown at us and adapting to the best of our abilities.
I did notice the term slow journalism used.
Yeah.
So talk about slow journalism.
So so I didn't study journalism, but the way that I understand it is we want to really have the time to focus on stories that are important on campus, be able to go and talk to a variety of sources, not be bogged down by the 1 week timeline, which really, when you look at it, is a 2 day timeline to get stuff out. And so having that month, it lets us go and talk to a lot more people, verify our sources a lot better, and make sure we're covering stories in a way that is more unique and more in depth.
Okay. Can I ask you about how students are consuming the news? Because there is that function, and the Ontarian is essentially a community newspaper. The community is just the university. But there's also the fact that it's your beat as well. It's no one's going to cover the university as well as the student paper. Mm-hmm. But in terms of how the readership is engaging, do students like bookmark the Ontarian page? Do they have like push notifications on the Ontarian Twitter feed, you know, when you guys post something? And, you know, we know that the physical paper itself may not be an essential part of their lives. And certainly when I first went here, and on Thursday morning, and the piles in front of the UC were, you know, a couple of thousand.
Yeah.
And everyone would grab one as they go into the UC Thursday morning. But on the digital end, does the Ontarian still have that same impact, do you think?
I think it's not possible on any medium to have that same impact. Like when you're the only game in town, everyone's going to grab that paper on their way into the UC. So they have other options on where they're getting their news. So we're never going to hit like that same thing that happened back then. But we are seeing a good increase in our web traffic. There was a little bit of a dip. We had some technical issues at the beginning of this year that took a couple of months, unfortunately, to get sorted out. So things like that do happen that are beyond our control. But in general, we've noticed that people are reading it still. And once you hit on a story that is of importance, then you see how many people actually read it. Because unless you have really strong feelings about something, you're not going to take the time to comment on it or share it. But when it is important to people, that will happen. And usually I tend to hear more from people who are unhappy with us than are happy with us. So that's, I guess, true of any profession where you're serving the public. But
I take it one of those was the Student Choice Initiative and a lot of the stuff around OSAP. I mean, that in a way, you don't want to phrase it this way, but Doug Ford did student press a favor by getting them to turn the spotlight on themselves.
Yeah, and I think it's good to have those conversations. And if anything, it's shown that people do really care and people are engaged. And most often the criticisms we get are that, you know, we lean a certain way or we're biased in a certain way. And our paper's written by the community. That's the community's voice right now. And if there are voices that aren't on that same side of things or whatever they think of the student choice. And I haven't had any students come to me and say, your coverage on this is biased and we love the student choice initiative. That hasn't happened. But if it did happen, if they wanted to write an opinion piece about how much they loved it, they're welcome to do that. It's just that hasn't been the case, really. In the last paper, we did a poll online and people commented, and we included, you know, a variety of those comments, and there's maybe one negative one person who was kind of for it and everyone else was kind of against it. So that just seems to be what the voice of the students is saying right now. I think it's it's good that these things are being brought into everyone's attention because they are important. And if something's just always there and you know it's always going to be there, then you don't feel the need to do something about it to make sure that that happens. But mm-hmm. when it gets threatened, people work pretty hard to make sure that those things that are important to them stay in place.
And I wonder how your team felt about, you know, essentially, they weren't specifically reporting on themselves. In a sense, they were, but I mean, they were also reporting on their industry. Mm-hmm. And I think I've struggled with this too, because I record this podcast. We're sitting here in this CFRU studio. Mm-hmm. I sort of depend on this place being open and help me do my thing. Yeah. How did you and your team deal with being part of the story?
I don't know how we dealt with it. I think we just we didn't have time to. Yeah, we didn't really have time to think about it. We just kind of got thrown at us when we had a bunch of other stuff going on too. So we probably couldn't even cover it as much as we wanted to, because we want to serve our volunteers as well, and not every single person that walks in necessarily wants to write about that. So our news editor, Mateo, did a really great job, I mm-hmm. think, covering the rallies, and whether it was in Toronto or on campus, and just trying to let students know what students' thoughts are right now on these changes that are pretty significant and will be, I think, detrimental for many years to come mm-hmm. In various ways. I think it's just... It's just calling it like a choice for students when clearly the democratic process has been ignored. I think that kind of hit all of us pretty hard in the newsroom, that like the marketing of it is like makes it so difficult to report on and explain like the nuances that right. are not clear maybe for people who maybe just see it in passing and aren't spending a lot of time reading about this stuff.
And the nuances aren't clear because I think, to my knowledge, unless something's happened in the last 20 minutes or so, they haven't released the details.
No, and the universities don't even really know what yeah. that final report is. It's like if they don't know what's happening, how is anyone supposed to create their operating budget? How are you supposed to hire staff? I thought the whole point of this was like that we were open for business and that we have jobs for people. And it's like, well, no, that's... You're making it so that a lot of people might not be hired in the future on campus, or like this shift to experiential learning, for example, that's happening on campus. If you get rid of all the places that are worth doing experiential learning at, then where are students getting those skills that you would get at like college or something like that? Where on university would you get those portfolio creation, resume building experiences?
Right. And the Ontarian is experiential learning.
Yes, absolutely.
It's, you know, there's no journalism program here, but you can certainly volunteer at the Ontarian and you are given the tools and the feedback yes. and the assistance you need. And it's from, you know, people who are maybe a little bit older than you or yeah. as, you know, depending on where you are in life and all that. But you came into this as not a journalism person, not someone who was interested in pursuing journalism. Are you interested now?
I think I fell more in love with the editing part of it than the journalism part of it.
Interesting.
There's a lot of aspects of the job that I really enjoy, but running a newsroom is exhausting. Like, it's you end one news cycle or one production week and you're already been working on the next one, not to mention like all the other things we do with volunteer training, which again is stuff that we want to improve. And that was one of the reasons we had planned on already running that referendum. We want mm-hmm. to have just better resources for our volunteers, have clear training in place, not just like throw them into an article and like, you know, learn to swim, as it were.
Although, I mean, that is how I learned
it. Yeah, it's a good way to learn. It's not, but it's also maybe not the best way for everyone to learn.
Sure.
Yeah.
No, of course. And I think I think, too, that we have sort of built, I don't know, I don't want to say a glass castle, but I feel that way sometimes, that journalism is, some people see it as inaccessible. And we also don't explain how we do things or why we do things as yes. often as we should, too.
Yeah.
So it's perhaps a good thing to sort of create an opportunity there to have more
yes.
experiential learning.
Yeah. And like, I mean, the point that you just made about, like, you know, making it clear how things are behind the scenes, that's something mm-hmm. that we've hoped to do a little bit more. We made like a little video showing kind of what a week of production looks like, because I think some people have the idea that they submit something to the paper and then we don't look at it and we just put it in the paper, but it goes through like 7 rounds of editing, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we are hoping next year, you know, to have some kind of regular column by the editor-in-chief or someone on staff that kind of explains the challenges within mm-hmm. the newsroom that we are facing, because there are a lot of them. And I think if the readership understood better why some things we can't do or can't cover in a certain way or not in the ways that they believe we should, there's usually reasons for it. And I think if people had that information, they would either come out and volunteer or at least be a little more
right.
understanding or forgiving of errors that, of course, are going to happen.
Yes. Yes. It's a learning environment.
Yes, absolutely.
And, I would also add that no media outlet is perfect either.
No.
I speak for myself and myself alone. No. I wanted to ask you then, Where are you heading next? Like, what's, you know, where do you see yourself going now? If not, you yeah. know, having a future byline in the Globe or the Star or whatever.
Yeah. I am going to be job searching as of like the beginning of May. And so I know that I want to work within education or writing in some capacity. I did my PhD here in theater studies. And so I'm kind of open to it. It's been really hard to figure that out at the Ontarian right now with all these things going on. So I've kind of just put a pin in it. But I'm sure that whatever I do next, I will have gained a lot of experience through my 3 years at the Ontarian and great references and a portfolio and everything. So going into the job search, I'm definitely in a much better place than I was when I was job searching 3 years ago.
So what has the experience taught you?
Definitely more about like conflict resolution and management and
yeah.
holding my tongue. No, yeah, and just knowing how to write for a general audience, to mm-hmm. speak for a general audience, not an academic specialized audience. I mm-hmm. think that we get really bogged down into these like essay forms and things like that. And then when you get into working, it's like no one wants you to do stuff like that, really.
Right.
So that stuff, and just, you know, being fearless in a certain capacity where it's okay to just call a person you don't know and ask them some questions and to figure out how to ask good questions, not mm-hmm. just yes or no's. And so a lot of things. I could probably talk about it for a long, long time in terms of what I've learned, or at least learned to do better. But We won't take up all your time talking about that right now.
Well, you have overseen a big transition. I'm not gonna, you know, this isn't necessarily your field, but I will ask you, because you've been living it the last few years.
Yeah.
What does the Ontarian look like in 5 years, do you think?
I think there's a lot of exciting things happening, to be honest. Like, it's cool that we're switching to more digital. I know, like, as someone who cares about the paper and is interested to see what's happening, I might not always have the time to grab the print copy, but I'll be able to go on my phone. And so maybe down the line, there might be like an app or something and more stuff to help new students get situated. Like, we're trying to refine the way that we put out that big Guelph 101 back to school guide. And
mm-hmm.
At the beginning of the school year. So there's, you know, definitely a trend towards being more service oriented. There's a lot of things, there's a lot of skill sets at the Ontarian that can be utilized beyond just the scope of journalism, because we you know, we have a bunch of editors, we have a bunch of writers, we have a bunch of people great at interviewing. So all of these things are transferable. So I think focusing on a lot of that stuff. And also we did a couple of experiential learning collaborations in the last paper, one with a history class that wrote about Treaty Number 3, mm-hmm. And another one with a philosophy class who wrote about ethics and autonomous vehicles. So being able to go into classrooms and giving students who, students are busy, they don't always have the time to go out of their way to come to the Ontarian and pick up a story. But if they get to do it as part of their assignments and that, and they're getting, you know, here's something I can use as part of a portfolio moving forward. We're hoping we can do more of that sort of thing for sure.
Do you feel, because I remember my years as a section editor, as an editor-in-chief, and, you know, the big bookcase with all the bound volumes.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it feels a bit daunting knowing that you'll be sitting there.
Yeah.
Likely till the end of the world.
Yeah, on that bookshelf. I hope nothing happens to those.
You know, how do you feel about where your legacy sits? What do you think when people open the books on Morali's ear?
Yeah.
And what do you think people will look back on that and say?
I feel really good about it. I'm sure I will also look at it at times and think about what I could have done better. And I have to remind myself that during the time with like the resources we had and the time we had, we did the best job that we could. I think the way we've covered things, especially this year after having having 1 year's experience going into it, I was able to cover things that maybe weren't always popular or the correct thing to cover, but what people cared about, the people in our newsroom saw as important. And I don't think that we're at a point where it's okay to just be completely objective and totally unbiased. I think it's our responsibility to draw attention to things that are very problematic in our current time. So I think we did that to the best of our ability, and hopefully I'll look back and feel good about that in 30 years and not feel like, oh, no, I was offending all these people unknowingly.
I'm not sure that will happen, but I thought it was a good year. I do flip through the paper still, and whoever was doing some of the cover designs was pretty spot on this year.
So that's Tiffany Aliani and Delora Griffiths are kind of our production team, and they had a really good vision and I think made the paper a lot more noticeable on the stands.
It was definitely that, and I know that any year is a tough year, but, you know, to have the institution itself having to defend it as at the same time having to do the hard work of grinding out the paper every year. I can imagine how hard it was, although I doubt it. I'm imagining it correctly. So compliments to you and compliments to the Ontarian team for a good
kind.
Year.
Thank you very much.
Now that we got the mushy stuff out of the way. Yeah. I will say thank you, Morali, for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And once again, that was Morali Amula. The Ontarian will be back on newsstands at the end of August with its Guelph 101 issue for new students, and it is always available online at theontarian.com. That's theontarian, all one word, .com. And that's it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics, and Sid Dale, the host for the Guelph Politicast, is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes, and while you're there, you can also listen to Open Source's Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. You can check out Guelph Politico on Facebook at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you'd like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating to Guelph Politico. And you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.